argument now in the case of United States against Horn. Ms. McAllister.
Morning. May it please the court. Defendant appellant Dewan Horn respectfully requests that his conviction be vacated as the government failed to demonstrate a nexus between his actions and interstate commerce, a required element of the Hobbs Act. In the alternative, Horn requests that his sentence be vacated.
What is your concept of interstate commerce?
Under the Hobbs Act, interstate commerce requires that there is a nexus between the accused conduct and interstate commerce. And when you're talking about...
I asked you what your concept of interstate commerce is, not what your concept of the Hobbs Act is.
My concept of interstate commerce under the Hobbs Act is that...
What do you think interstate commerce means?
It's business flowing, the sale of goods, purchase of goods, the business across state lines.
How about salesmen traveling from state to state? Is that interstate commerce?
I believe so.
How about the telephone network? Do you think the federal government can regulate what happens on the telephone network?
I do believe so. And
indeed, the telephone network is usually given as one of the paradigms of the means and instrumentalities of interstate commerce. Well, that same network is what your client used to perpetrate this crime. Why, therefore, doesn't one say that the interstate commerce element is just met as soon as you log on to eBay?
Because
the instrumentalities of interstate commerce have been used, QED.
Because what's before the court today is the standard of proof. And when you're talking about the Hobbs Act, generally...
Well, there isn't any proof issue. The facts are
clear enough.
Yeah.
I would argue that there was not sufficient proof to establish a nexus between Horn's actions and interstate commerce.
Are you doubting that there was proof that your client logged on to eBay?
There was discussion of eBay and telephone wires. I don't think there was a discussion framed in a manner that the jury could make a conclusion that telephone wires are part of interstate commerce.
Are you doubting that there is proof from which the jury could find that your client logged onto eBay?
No, I would say there was sufficient proof of that.
All right. Are you doubting that the telephone network or the Internet is part of the means and instrumentalities of interstate commerce?
No, but I'm trained in the law.
QED. Case is over at that point.
Well, then I'd like to move on to my sentencing argument, please. In the alternative, we argue that Horn's sentence should be vacated and remanded for resentencing, as his current sentence, which has been enhanced substantially based primarily on acquitted conduct, violates not only his Fifth and Sixth Amendment rights, but is also unreasonable under the sentencing guidelines. Horn's sentence should be vacated and remanded because, as it currently stands, it violates his Fifth and Sixth Amendment rights. In the wake of Booker, a sentencing enhancement based...
As you know, we've rejected this argument already in United States against Price.
Yes, I do.
I have some difficulty seeing why we should reconsider Price. The idea behind Price is that an acquittal shows that conduct has not been established beyond a reasonable doubt. But sentencing is determined based on the preponderance of the evidence. And it's easy to see how there can be evidence... You know, say at the 75% probability level, it flunks reasonable doubt, it satisfies preponderance. Why could that evidence not be used in sentencing?
Because I think once the defendant has chosen to exercise his right to a jury trial, then you have to defer to the jury's fact-finding on this point.
What the jury found is that he is not guilty. That is, that guilt has not been established beyond a reasonable doubt. The jury does not find that the defendant didn't do it. The jury finds that the defendant has not been proved to have done it beyond a reasonable doubt. That's all the verdict means.
Certainly I understand that, Your Honor.
It's perfectly common, see O.J. Simpson, for somebody to be acquitted of murder at trial and found in a civil proceeding to be a murderer and ordered to pay damages.
Certainly, but there wasn't a civil proceeding against Mr.
Horn. But it's the difference between beyond a reasonable doubt and preponderance, and that's the difference that's in play here. Jury says not beyond a reasonable doubt, and the judge says yes by a preponderance.
I understand, but the Constitution gives Mr. Horn the right to a jury trial, and the jury trial.
But do you think, for example, that it's improper to base a sentence in part on a person's criminal history?
No, I'm not arguing that. I'm speaking specifically.
Isn't that the logic of your position, that the jury should have to find beyond a reasonable doubt that this individual committed these previous crimes before they can be used to influence a sentence?
No, my position is that when the jury has actually made a finding, that
that's wrong, because they didn't make a finding on this issue. Oh, you say, but...
What I'm saying,
but
I'm
they
not...
didn't. If they made, it's one thing if they made a finding, he in fact did not brandish a gun. But if they just find, as Chief Judge Easterbrook was asking, that it hasn't been proved beyond a reasonable doubt, that's not a finding that it didn't happen. It's a finding that it hasn't been proved.
Yes, Your Honor, I'm sorry, I misspoke. What I'm saying, though, as to criminal conduct and prior history, that's not before us, and that's not what we're arguing today.
No, so the question is the logic of your argument. Your argument seems to be that the only basis on which you can determine a person's sentence is proof beyond a reasonable doubt before a jury. Whereas obviously a lot of things that influence sentencing, characteristics of the defendant and so on, are not before the jury, wouldn't be proper to be put before the jury, right?
Certainly, but I don't see in our brief how we're arguing that that's inappropriate
much as... What's the logic?
The logic is that when you put something before the jury, which was done in this case as to the count five, and the jury makes its finding a fact, which is that it was not proven beyond a reasonable doubt.
Yeah, but that's not a finding of fact, not proved beyond a reasonable doubt, right? That's not a fact finding.
Mr. McAllister, let's leave alone for a moment the constitutionality of considering evidence upon which a person was found not guilty at a criminal trial. We also have to find that this sentence was reasonable. You do make in your brief, and I'd appreciate your expanding a bit on it, why would it have been unreasonable to consider this evidence in the sentencing of your client?
Thank you, Your Honor. I believe it's unreasonable because when you're applying the sentencing guidelines, there's the factors set forth. And one of them is that the sentence has to focus on the nature and circumstances of the offense. We argue that a six-level enhancement based only on the court's guess of how circumstances would have evolved, which is anticipatory guesswork, is by its very nature unreasonably. Furthermore, the sentence needs to promote respect for the law. Sentencing based on acquitted conduct, as I've argued before, I believe eviscerates the jury's role in the judicial system and allows the judge to substitute his or her opinion, giving the government a second bite at the apple at a lower burden of proof.
Suppose we would not want to establish an across-the-board rule that considering evidence of factual evidence upon which an individual had been found not guilty by a jury is per se unreasonable.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any particular fact or factors in your case which make it unreasonable? In other words, can we give your client relief without establishing a general rule?
I believe so. I believe that the evidence presented was that that Mr. Rogers, the gentleman who actually committed the attempted armed robbery, was not acting with Mr. Horn's knowledge. There was testimony that another individual called these men after the fact, didn't realize what was going on, had no idea that this person was out there, that he'd been spoken to. Mr. Rogers himself testified that Mr. Horn did not know what was going to happen that day. And so I think based on those facts, it's not reasonable to impute that knowledge to him and say that that is foreseeable to him when the gentleman who did it himself said he didn't know I was going to do it. I'd like to reserve time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Certainly, Ms. McAllister. Mr. Ong.
Thank you, Your Honors. Winfield Ong, Assistant United States Attorney for the United States Appellee. I'll address the interstate effect on interstate commerce issue briefly. I suggest that the only thing that could be remotely complex about this issue is how simple it is. For whatever reason, it seems the United States has typically chosen to use the Hobbs Act on a fact pattern that fits the depletion of assets theory. The standard jury instruction, in fact, follows the depletion of assets theory. The judge modified it to fit the facts here. I'd suggest his modified jury instruction was entirely appropriate. And in fact, his finding that this did fit the Hobbs Act interstate requirement of effect on interstate commerce was could fit that was entirely appropriate based on the advertisement in interstate commerce, the negotiations in interstate commerce, and the travel of customers and their money in interstate commerce. This court did note in Peterson a single robbery intrastate that it would have been sufficient to have met the burden under the Hobbs Act if the government had merely showed that the marijuana that generated the proceeds that were stolen had been were drugs sold to out-of-state customers. And this is obviously a situation involving much more elaborate interstate scheme than was had been present in Peterson with those facts. And in fact, I'd suggest that the precedent that this establishes may be, perhaps unfortunately, but an important one for the future, given the cleverness of this scheme and its use of interstate commerce attributes, the internet and the telephone.
It doesn't seem particularly clever. You advertise something expensive, and then when somebody shows up to buy it, you rob him. This is not the work of a criminal mastermind.
Well, I'm sorry, I've overstated it. I should say that it could. It's something. In fact, perhaps on the contrary, clever, but something that could be very susceptible to future application and an important use of federal resources and the government's ability to investigate interstate crime. I'll address the second, the use of the acquitted conduct as the supplemental authorities of that Horn has filed himself show several circuits that have addressed this issue. I think three more since Price have all found, similar to this court in Price, the 10th, 11th circuits, the D.C. Circuit, the Second Circuit, and the Eighth Circuit, that acquitted conduct can be considered at sentencing. I would emphasize only that the district court in this case gave substantial time and analysis on the record to why he was considering that conduct and what the...
Refresh my recollection. What was the district court's reason for considering it?
He found, first of all, that Horn, and the evidence was, in the case, amply supported that Horn was a leader, was the leader of this organization. His resume was found during the search and showed that he had a lot of very high-level skills. The judge observed Rogers, the co-conspirator that did draw the gun, for which Horn was acquitted, was a particularly unsophisticated person from the judge's observation at trial, and that there was an elaborate, a compelling pattern, I'll call it, already established at trial, three prior robberies within, I believe, 2 days of this robbery that resulted in the acquitted 924C, that all followed the exact same pattern. Using Horn's eBay email address. Also, the name James Arnold was used in one of the prior robberies, who Horn later identified himself as to one of the victims. And the judge found that given the pattern of the scheme and the prior witnesses, the conspiracy for which Horn was convicted, and that those other
crime he was found not guilty of was not a conspiracy, am I correct?
That's right. He was found guilty of the conspiracy, and those prior robberies were proved up for that purpose. And so that was the basis that the judge found that Horn, it was reasonably foreseeable to Horn that a gun would be used by Rogers.
Was the jury given a Pinkerton instruction with respect to the crime for which he was found not guilty?
I don't believe it. They were, Your Honor. I guess the judge went so far as to even provide, I thought, a substantial reason on the record for why the jury might have acquitted Horn, apart from the merits. I don't think that was necessary or required by any means, but he did, and it was amply supported his finding on the record.
Do you think it would ever be unreasonable for a district court to consider in sentencing a factor that or a crime for which an individual had been found not guilty?
Well, I guess I think there's maybe two answers to that. I think certainly it could be unreasonable if the facts do not support by a preponderance of the evidence in that instance. But apart from that instance, I don't believe so.
Otherwise, you think it needs to be an across-the-board, per se, ironclad rule?
That's my impression of the law, and I think it's appropriate.
That's your impression of the constitutionality.
Yes, Your Honor.
Yeah, okay.
And I don't have any further argument unless there are other questions from the court. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Owen. Anything further, Ms. McAllister?
Mr. McAllister, did the Assistant United States Attorney convince you that it was reasonable to use this information against your client?
And no, he did not.
And why?
Because my client has due process rights, and his sentence was enhanced based on something presented to the jury and not proven to the jury. And I don't think that the government gets a second chance.
But that's your other and hopeless argument. Is there anything in 3553A which would suggest that there may be some cases where the use of acquitted conduct to raise a sentence is improper?
Certainly, I think that if we are looking to avoid unwarranted sentencing disparities between similarly situated defendants, the use of acquitted conduct becomes problematic, particularly given the number of district courts that are declining to consider such conduct or subjecting it to a higher reasonable doubt standard. And again, as I stated earlier, I'm
very puzzled. Now you seem to be saying the fact that some other district courts make legal errors means that your client is entitled to a lower sentence. Is that what you're saying?
I am saying that the fact that certain district courts throughout the country are changing their standards means that under the sentencing guidelines,
yes, and
it's difficult.
Under our standard, that means that they're making mistakes, right?
Yes,
those judges are not following the law as we understand it. But am I correctly getting your argument that as long as some other judges make legal errors, your client is entitled to a lower sentence? Your client is entitled to the benefit of the same legal error?
My client is entitled to the benefit of a uniform sentence for people with similarly situated offenses. And I would say that if certain courts are not doing that, until there is a decision one way or another across the board, my client is not being treated equally under the sentencing guidelines.
Well, thank you, Ms. McAllister, and we appreciate your willingness and that of your firm to accept the appointment and the assistance you've been both to your client and the court. Thanks very much. The case is taken under advisement.